Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by Remy Martin, Cognac, France, since 1724. Information available, 800-678-REMY.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year is our show's 10th anniversary year. On this archive edition, we'll listen back to some memorable moments from our first year, 1987. When we launched the show, we weren't yet well-known enough to get some of the big-name actors and directors. Our movie guests tended to be people on their way up or on their way down. And we landed some pretty interesting behind-the-scenes folks, like bug wrangler David Brody. Here's an excerpt of our 1987 interview. Are you troubled by crawling insects? E.G. Marshall was.
Bug problem. Once you get bugs, never get rid of them. Breed in the crawl spaces, in the conduits, in the very core of the building itself.
In the film Creepshow, E.G. Marshall played a millionaire Howard Hughes-type hermit whose germ-free penthouse was mysteriously infested by cockroaches. These cockroaches were supplied and handled by entomologist David Brody. In Hollywood parlance, he's known as a bug wrangler. In the new film, The Believers, he worked with tarantulas and centipedes. But his tour de force was directing more than 22,000 cockroaches for Creepshow. I asked David Brody how he rounded up all those bugs, including 2,000 giant roaches from Trinidad.
I made some calls to Washington, and I found out that if I was very careful, I can import the giant cave roach from Trinidad. They flew us to Trinidad, and you would sit on the floor of the cave, and the cave floor was covered in bat guano, bat droppings. Now, because the cave was dry, these droppings had the consistency of coffee beans. You would sit down on the floor with your legs crossed, and the ground, the coffee beans would undulate, because beneath them were the roaches. And we got about two-thirds of the roaches that we needed out of that. And then we went down to the lower cave, and that was a very wet cave, very disturbing cave because it was narrow and constricting. And there was one point within that cave where you really had to wiggle through. And that's when the bats left that cave, they made a slight drop in their flight path, and that's where they defecated. So you had water dripping there. Now, coming out of the cave after collecting the roaches, my hand sort of slipped into that morass. And I wanted to amputate my hand at that point. It was very, very unpleasant.
The name that you're given when you work on a movie is roach wrangler or tarantula wrangler.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the word wrangler used for your line of work?
That's a movie term. Horse wranglers, cow wranglers, and it sort of just trickled down. But I think it's a good term. I think it's exactly what we do.
How do you control roaches on a set? If they're actors, you tell them what their positions are, and you yell positions, and everything's all set. How do the roaches know where their positions are?
You build corrals for them, and you give the impression that they're doing things. And you can get them to move in directions by air current, by light. The very things that govern their lives, essentially, is how we use them. The scenes where they're coming up out of the sink were done with giant plastic syringes, and we just sort of pumped them in. My favorite scene in that movie was, of course, the bed scene, when he flips the covers off the bed, and the whole bed is just covered with a mass of undulating roaches. I thought that was just really terrific.
One of my concerns would be, if I were doing a movie like this, is what happens to the roaches after the shoot? You have 22,000 roaches running around a set. I mean, who'd want 22,000 roaches, not only in the set, but added to the city that it's being filmed in? Is there any way to ensure that you can gather them all up and control them when you're finished?
Well, the government regulations that I had with the permit stated that all the imported roaches had to be frozen and then burned, which is what we did. It was a wonderful job, by the way. It wasn't one that I was particularly happy to do. I don't like to kill animals, I really don't, but it was the only way. We just had too many of them to deal with.
Are there any ethical questions that you run into in your line of work, since you must get asked to do very unusual things with insects?
In my mind, I don't like to kill any insect unless I absolutely have to. And frequently, I did a shoot just with live bees recently, and I returned those bees to the wild. And I did The Believers, and there was a scene in The Believers where I had to pick up a live centipede and run a pin through it. And I had a very hard time deciding whether I would do it. And I finally did a little bit of research into the anatomy of the insect and the physiology of the insect. It's not an insect, I'm sorry, it's an arachnid. And I decided that I could do it, and the animal would survive. And I did it. As a matter of fact, we had to do that take twice, and the animal is still alive at the museum, in my office at the museum. So the research there paid off. But I don't think I would do it again. I really don't. It really disturbed me. I mean, the scene was dynamite in the movie. It was a very nice scene, but it really bothered me to do it.
What bothers you is the thought of torturing insects.
That's right. I don't like to do that at all.
Well, one of the most shocking moments in recent entertainment television was when the magicians Penn and Teller appeared on the David Letterman show, and Letterman said, "I want you to really surprise me." So Teller put his magician's hat on Letterman's desk, then lifted it up a little bit later to reveal hundreds of roaches, which immediately took over Letterman's desk. Letterman was absolutely horrified, or at least that's how
he sure was.
He appeared to be. Now, you were the wrangler that Penn and Teller used to get those roaches. When they called you up and asked you to surprise David Letterman live on television, what did you think of the idea?
Well, it was a matter of getting Penn and Teller to learn to handle the insects, and they did that pretty well. When it came to the final roundup, they just pitched in and helped. They helped me scoop them up, which says a lot for Penn and Teller. And we got them all back, except for one, which showed up the next night when Julia Child was doing some cooking, I understand. I thought that was rather amusing.
Bug wrangler David Brody recorded in 1987. When I first started watching movies in the 1950s, women on screen seemed far better endowed than the mothers in my neighborhood. In 1987, I learned why when I interviewed an ex-blonde bombshell. Here's an excerpt of an interview from our first year as a national program.
She was born Jane Olander in a small South Dakota town. When she was 15, she was discovered by Howard Hughes and was on her way to becoming a Hollywood starlet. When she landed a movie contract at Universal in 1953, the studio changed her name to Mamie Van Doren. They were hoping that she would be the next Marilyn Monroe. But unlike Marilyn, she became best known for movies about rock and roll and teen rebellion. By the mid-60s, roles for blonde bombshells like Mamie Van Doren had dried up, and she left Hollywood. She played dinner theaters and summer stock and put together a nightclub act. Now Mamie Van Doren has written a memoir about her wild Hollywood adventures on and off screen and in and out of bed. She told me about one of the props that enhanced her sexpot image, the pointed padded bra.
The wardrobe department at the studio had made them, and they had made them for women there that didn't have as large as breasts as mine, but they said that I was to wear one even though my breasts were large, and I followed the orders, and lo and behold, my God, dangerous weapons.
Did you have to be careful that you didn't walk into objects?
Well, especially two-legged men when men with pants on.
What were they made of, those bras, so that they'd keep their shape?
Well, the one that I had was, it was lined with satin. It was very smooth, so it almost looked like skin. And what they did is they took a bridal button, and then they would sew it to make it look like a nipple. Like you walked around with hard nipples all the time.
Did the studio expect you to wear those padded bras in your off hours so that you could maintain the image?
One I had at the studio, and then they had another one for me to take home, to wear. So I guess they did. They expected me to keep that image.
But did you?
No, I didn't like wearing bras. I always just sort of, I wore them when I went to the studio, but sometimes I didn't, and then the head office would call me in and tell me that I had to put my bra back on. I mean, the 60s was a feminist movement, and they burned their bras, and it was really the end of the platinum blonde era, but I welcomed it because I was really for that scene. I mean, I just didn't like what I had to do.
You were introduced to rock and roll by starring in rock and roll movies. Which are some of the rock and roll movies you were in?
I did Running Wild, and then I did Untamed Youth at Warner Brothers, which didn't get a seal of approval because it was too risque. I did High School Confidential. College Confidential, Girls Town. Well, I've done quite a few. Sex Kittens Go to College.
You even sang The Girl Who Invented Rock and Roll. Do you remember the lyrics? Could you do a chorus of it?
Now you've heard of instant coffee, you've heard of instant tea. See here, you guys, just feast your eyes on little old instant me, 'cause I'm the girl, oh, I'm the girl, I'm the girl who invented rock and roll.
That's great. It's just great. Well, High School Confidential is about...
marijuana and all that.
Yeah, it's a young hipster who's asked to infiltrate a high school and find out who's dealing dope. And it's very moralistic at the end about how this could happen in your school.
Oh, I think it's hilarious. I watch that occasionally and see myself falling drunk on the floor. Charlie, one thing I can't stand is a man who can't hold his liquor. You know, and then I collapse over this guy.
Well, I was thinking that probably while you were making this movie that was supposed to have this anti-drug moral at the end, that probably half the actors...
were stoned.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm sure. In fact, I know one of them was. You know, you got us through his lines. Oh, yeah, it was going on then. I mean, marijuana didn't just happen. That thing has been going around since God knows.
So much of your book is about your sexual adventures, including how you once tried to buy a gross of condoms because a lot of the men were really irresponsible about birth control, so you figured you'd better carry it yourself. And I couldn't help but think how different your life would have been had you been coming of age now.
We still had a couple of bad venereal diseases, and also we did not have legal abortions. And if you got pregnant, you know, you lent yourself to a butcher and, you know... And that was quite common in those days. So it was, you know, you had problems then, too. It wasn't all that easy. But I would not want to be out in the jungle today. I mean, I really feel for the people that are promiscuous, and they have to really be careful.
You know, you mentioned the risks that women have always taken when they engage in sex. You know, if for instance, if they don't want to get pregnant, there's always that risk of pregnancy. And when you were younger, abortion was illegal. Was that on your mind a lot? Did you always have this sense of risk during your period when you were having a lot of relationships?
Very much so. That was the first thing you thought of. Well, what time of the month is it? You know, you're very scared because... When you sign a contract at a studio, there's a clause in any act of God that any kind of scandal, I mean, you're automatically dropped. And I always remember when I was very young, I was growing up and I watched and looked at the newspapers when poor Ingrid Bergman was just absolutely, she was deported from this country just because she was pregnant by another man. I mean, it was just, I mean, that scared me. I mean, I really got scared. And you grow up with these fears, and the only thing I could think of was just go out and buy my own condoms. And if they didn't have them, I had one for them. Well, I just happen to have one. If you want, you know, I mean, a lot of men were really taken aback to think that I was thinking like that. I mean, they got mad sometimes, you know. I'd say, well, it's your problem, you know.
Did you end up having to give sexual responsibility and birth control lectures to a lot of the men who you slept with?
No, if they were that dumb, I just didn't like them. I mean, I don't like dumb men. If they aren't aware of taking care of me as a woman at that time, as young as I was, I just didn't go to bed with them. I think men are the opposite. Men will marry dumb women, but I don't think smart women will marry dumb men.
Mamie Van Doren, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Mamie Van Doren, recorded in 1987. On this archive edition, we're listening back to interviews from our first year as a Daily National program. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. As I mentioned earlier, in our first year, 1987, when we were struggling to establish a national reputation, we booked a lot of movie people who were on their way up, like Robert Townsend. 1987 was the year his film Hollywood Shuffle was released, which he wrote, directed, and starred in. This now classic comedy was the semi-autobiographical story of a young black actor who learns that the only parts available to him are absurd black stereotypes. Here's an audition scene from the film.
Anyway, after getting my degree from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, I decided to come to Hollywood and do some movies.
Good. Why don't you start with the speech? That's very interesting.
Sure. Okay. Let me see. I ain't afraid of you. What is happening with your cool vines?
Thank you. Thank you.
You're the worst actor I've ever seen in my life. I have to be frank with you.
I could do it in iambic.
You be messing with the wrong dude, bro.
Thank you. That was very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice. Did you like it?
Very much.
I ain't be got no weapon.
In 1987, Robert Townsend's memories of auditioning for stock roles as pimps and junkies were still fresh.
I didn't know how to speak up at that point because every actor in town was in there auditioning, and I said, wait, this is a terrible script. Maybe it's me. And then I started thinking about it, and I would go in and read a script, and I go, this is terrible. And then the next guy, this is the greatest pimp I've ever read, you know. And I think it had to do with, you know, I began back then to begin to look and see something was wrong.
What kind of roles were you auditioning for that you're talking about?
Stoolies on TV shows, you know, the guys that always have the information that the cops always talk to, Huggy Bear, Turkey Neck, you know, they always have those weird names. So those are the kind of parts I would audition for.
Are you convincing in that kind of role?
I'm a good actor. I could pull it off. Yeah, I mean, I consider myself a good actor. You know, I wouldn't mind doing a street character if I could play a lawyer next week and a doctor the week after that, or a detective like Sam Ace or something like that.
But the problem is there aren't many roles like that to play.
Right. They always write the stereotypical, you know, just jive street.
The character in your movie is directed to be blacker while he's playing a part or auditioning for a part. Were you ever directed to be more black?
Oh, yeah, because, see, the way I talk, when you're considered black, you're supposed to talk like, well, yeah, baby, you know, I'm doing this interview and things with you. So that's the way I should talk. That's considered black. If I was saying, like, oh, this is national radio, baby, that's black. But the way I'm talking now, then they say, well, you don't sound black. I mean, you could, you know, if I was just tuning in, I would say, is this a black person? I don't give you the key words. And so a lot of times they ask you to be black or because black is, you know, all the, you know, sitcoms of the 70s. And they say what? So that's considered black.
What are some of the movies you liked when you were growing up?
Wizard of Oz. My favorite film of all time is Here Comes Mr. Jordan with Robert Montgomery. That was one of my favorite films.
I love that film. That's the film about the boxer who's been reincarnated, basically, sent back
right.
down to Earth.
Yeah, Claude Rains, Robert Montgomery, and Warren Beatty did the updated version with, Buck Henry and James Mason. It's like, Joe, listen, Joe, you're not Pendleton, Joe. You can't stay in this body, Joe. You know, that was one of my favorite films.
As a teenager, did you like any of the exploitation films like Shaft and Superfly?
I love those movies because that was the first time we saw the black man get the girl. You know, I remember seeing the scene in Superfly when he made love in the bathtub, and it was like, I can't believe this. Because other than that, black people had played butlers, and it's like, you want your luggage, Mr. Jenkins? And that was the only role we played. And so when you saw Shaft, and he had a gun, and he slapped people around, and he fought for right, you know, it was like, great. We'd never seen it. Because normally, the black actor was the buddy to the star. He never, you know, like, he never was the man. You know, he never was in charge and said, I'm fighting for right. And that's what I'm going to do here. You guys are bad, you know. And Shaft was that way, and Superfly was that way. I just think that they made more pimp movies than they made movies about, you know, black people from the regular walks of life. I think that's what messed everything up. There were too many negative role models. I mean, if they would have had a pimp movie and then a movie about a doctor, then a movie about a lawyer, and a movie about a guy who was in love, everything would have been fine. But it was just, you know, 90 pimp movies versus one sounder. You know, that was what the deal was.
You started as a comic, I think, before you became an actor. And you do great impressions. Did you do impressions a lot as a kid? Did you do impressions of teachers or movie stars, family?
Yeah, I did a lot of impressions. I used to cheat the phone company. I used to call because I didn't have money. And when I was, you know, going to the basketball court, I would call the fellas, and that's how I used my talent back then. I'd get on the phone and, hello, operator, I'm sorry, I deposited a dime in the telephone. I can't reach this number. Yes, operator, my name is Dr. John Wilson. Yes, thank you for putting me through, operator. Thank you. Yo, Willie, how you doing, man? Yeah, meet me at the gym, 4:30. So I would do different voices and characters as a kid.
Oh, that's great. Did that work, by the way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you never knew who I was. I mean, because I'd get on the phone and I was like, hello, operator. My name's Paul Ogemeyer. I'm trying to reach, you know, Deborah Jenkins. That's right. You know, I just got it from Cheshire. I deposited a dime in the telephone. I can't get it back. So no one would never know who I was.
Why did you go into acting from being a comic?
Well, I wanted to be an actor first. I wanted to be a dramatic actor and everybody would laugh at me. So I said, I should be a comedian.
Did they really laugh at you?
They really said I would do a dramatic scene and people would laugh. And I was going, wait a minute, that was dramatic. That was drama. And people go, no, you're funny, man. You're funny. No, that's funny. You know, and I said, let me be a comedian then.
Robert Townsend recorded in 1987 after the release of his movie Hollywood Shuffle. In the second half of our show, we'll hear more interviews from our first year as a Daily National program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.